If your periods are changing, this might signal that you're going through a shift in your hormones, and that's going to influence the type of migraines you're having. Even in somebody who maybe never has had menstrual-related migraines, they start going through this shift in their cycle, and now they're starting to notice that they're having much more frequent migraines, and it could be related to hormonal changes. A lot of times our patients want tests, or they want to go and pursue getting their hormones checked, but I actually don't find that to be terribly helpful. Your hormones might be normal at the time you got them checked. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's not an irregularity in their levels.
What is the connection between migraine and female hormones during the different stages of a woman's life? Puberty, reproductive years, perimenopause, and menopause. For many women, the onset of migraine happens during puberty, and menstrual migraine is very common. What does the current research tell us about this connection? And what are some effective ways to deal with migraine at these different stages? We are going to dive into these questions with Dr. Jessica Ailani. Dr. Ailani is the director of the MedStar Georgetown Headache Center. She's a specialist in headache and women's health and is dedicated to patient education. Dr. Ailani, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
What is the connection between migraine and female hormones like estrogen?
So it's a good question. Many of our patients are always surprised when they come to talk to us about having migraines and why it seems to be more common in their girlfriends or their mother or their grandmother than maybe their father or their husband. And so we talk a lot about how the female reproductive system and the hormone cycle really does play a strong role in how migraines come about for women. So we know that migraines are more common in women than men, and we have a strong sense that this is related to the hormone cycle. And when you think about what happens in a woman who's of reproductive years, we have cycling that occurs with our hormones. There are times that estrogen is low in our cycle, and there are times that estrogen peaks and then drops suddenly. And it's the shifting in estrogen levels that we think can precipitate migraine in many women who have migraines.
So it sounds like estrogen really is the culprit in this.
We think so. We think that estrogen is the big player, and we can see that during different times in a woman's life where estrogen levels really shift, they can have more frequent migraines, less frequent migraines, and that there's a sense too that estrogen plays a role in aura, which is another phenomenon that can occur during migraine. When levels are really high, you might not have headache pain, but you might get aura more often. And when levels are lower, you might have that shift where you're getting more migraines, but maybe the aura symptoms start to get better. So there's a really interesting connection between cycling of estrogen and all the symptoms that come along with migraine.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that about the aura. Very interesting. Well, what is the difference between hormonal migraine and migraine, or is there a difference?
So when we look at hormonal migraine, we often call this diagnostically, we call these menstrual migraine. And really, the difference isn't in symptoms, but the timing and when they're occurring. So a person who has menstrual migraines can also have regular migraines, as we would call them, or migraine without aura, migraine with aura. Those are times in their 30-month cycle where they're not having shifts in hormone changes, and the migraines can be triggered by nothing or various other things like stress, lack of sleep, dehydration. Symptoms are very similar, and we know migraine symptoms. They're that one-sided, very severe throbbing pain, worse with physical activity, comes with that upset stomach, light sensitivity, and inability to really function. With menstrual-related migraines, you can have those same symptoms, but they tend to be triggered around the time of shifts in hormones. So anywhere from 3 days before the start of your menstrual cycle to 3 days after the start of menstrual cycle. And we know that this can occur in anywhere up to 6 out of 10 women who are having migraines. Some can have pure menstrual-related migraines, meaning they have a migraine every month around their cycle, no other migraines through the month time period. But what's actually more common is what we call menstrual-related migraines. You have your migraines with menses, and then you have your migraines the other times of month. And when you ask these patients who have both, they'll often tell you it's a lot more difficult to handle those that are related to menses. They last longer, they don't respond as easily to treatment, and these are the ones that really they know they're going to be disabled, not only from symptoms of menses, but the symptoms from the migraine itself.
In 2010, you wrote an article, "Do Sex Hormones Influence Tension-Type Headache? What were the findings with it?
So it's actually quite a controversial article. I was asked to write this review on tension headaches and the hormone cycle. And I remember thinking, okay, yes, every one of us have had a headache around our cycle. So there's going to be tons of information out there. There's actually very little that's been looked at or written about tension headaches and how they relate to the hormone cycle, because there's this constant belief that you can only get migraines around your menstrual cycle, but not headaches. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that women will naturally get headaches related to menses, but they don't go and talk to their doctor about that or their clinician. They go and they say, oh, of course, I have a headache. I'm going to take something over the counter. My period's coming, and I'm going to move on with my life. So in our article, we discussed the idea that tension headaches can actually be quite common during the menstrual cycle, and that some other classical triggers that we usually think purely are connected to migraine can actually be triggers in tension type headache as well, like stress or even weather changes, where we always historically think of a weather shift might be causing migraine, but there are several patients who've reported weather shifts just causing a milder form of a headache, that they're like, oh, well, it's about to rain and I'm just going to move on with our lives. So it's an interesting idea that in the literature, sometimes we take things as we know this because we have literature on it, but sometimes gaps in knowledge doesn't necessarily mean that it's not happening. Mm-hmm. It just means that people aren't talking about it.
Well, and does this or did this refer to women's hormones only, or can men also have hormonal factors?
Yeah, I think that the idea of why are some men more likely to have migraine than others, and how much does the hormones play a role in men, is a very interesting one. There's a lot of ideas, not a lot of research, but a lot of ideas out there about testosterone, that we know testosterone potentially has an anti-inflammatory effect, and that testosterone could potentially be protective against pain. So is it possible that certain men have low testosterone levels, and this, in fact, can be a trigger for having migraines? It's not too substantiated, and the problem really started that when people wanted to study this, there became a lot of information about testosterone treatment maybe leading to some other secondary unwanted consequences like prostate cancer. So I think it really quickly put a stop to the idea of what if we study replacing testosterone in patients who have migraines for men, and is it potential that they're losing some of that protective factor that testosterone is providing, and that makes them more prone to having migraines, especially if they had a family history. So it's an interesting area to study, but unfortunately a lot of that work got stopped because of treatment. I mean, if we don't have a treatment option for this, what are we really learning then?
Right, that makes sense and understandable. And we do ask our viewers to submit questions and topics to us. Mm-hmm. And Kelly asks, I have never met a migraine doctor who understood female hormones or an OBGYN who could help with my migraine. This means I have to go back and forth to multiple doctors to get any treatments worked out. What is the best way to get answers?
Yeah, I can imagine how frustrating that must be for Kelly. And a lot of our patients really do feel that difficulty in coordinating their care. You know, how am I supposed to make sense of all of this information that I read? And I can see that there's this link between hormones and migraines. So why can't one of my doctors just figure out what my hormone problem is and stop all of the hormone cycling? I think some of the complicated things there is that this isn't something that's well studied in school. There's not a lot of lectures on hormone cycles and migraines. And many of us who go into headache or who are headache specialists, unless we have a mentor who this is what they're really interested in, or we go out into practice and we realize this is a big bulk of what we're seeing, don't really go on to understand that intimate connection between hormone changes and migraines. So some piece of advice I have for any of my patients that feel there might be a hormone link to their migraines, I ask them to calendar not only their headaches, but their cycles and any symptoms that they think might be related to cycles. So sometimes what we see in women who are perimenopausal, so this time period is when women are starting to have irregularities in their cycles. Periods are longer, periods are shorter, periods are heavier, periods are lighter, they're coming more often, they're coming less often. And I think there's not a clear understanding that women have that they can actually come more often, and that's a sign of perimenopause, or they can disappear and then come back, then disappear and come back. So I ask them to track that, but also track, maybe you didn't get a period, but did you feel some breast tenderness? Did you notice mood changes? Did you notice an appetite change? Did you feel more bloated? All those symptoms that you might get when you're about to get a period, did you have some of those symptoms, have a bunch of migraines, and never get a period? Because that can be a sign of some shifting in hormones. So I would advise to somebody who's wondering if there's a hormonal link with their migraines to track their hormone cycles, meaning symptoms that are coming around the time of their periods, and also track their migraines, and then bring that information to their provider and have a conversation about I think there's a connection here. And if they don't feel that their provider is really listening to them, it might be a signal to, you know, search to find somebody who's going to take a look at that information and really try to make that connection.
You kind of touched on this, but how do you know if you might have an abnormal hormonal balance or function? Yeah.
So really, the female body is an amazing thing. It's going to tell us that you're having imbalances because you're going to have symptoms. So if you're, again, the biggest thing is if you're noticing abnormalities in your cycle, they're longer, they're shorter, they're heavier, they're lighter, anything that's different than your normal, and you track that. A lot of times people don't pay attention to these things, or they're grateful they haven't had a period for a month or two, but then they wonder why they're feeling better or potentially feeling worse. And then you're like, well, if your periods are changing, this might signal that you're going through a shift in your hormones, and that's going to influence the type of migraines you're having. Even in somebody who maybe never has had menstrual-related migraines, they start going through this shift in their cycle, and now they're starting to notice that they're having much more frequent migraines, and it could be related to hormonal changes. A lot of times our patients want tests, or they want to go and pursue getting their hormones checked, but I actually don't find that to be terribly helpful. Your hormones might be normal at the time you got them checked. That doesn't necessarily mean that there's not an irregularity in their levels. And I think there's this misconception that we can check your hormone level at one time and it tells us a big picture about what's going on in your cycle. But all that one-time check is telling us is within that couple of days, what were your hormones doing? Or it looks like the levels are so low, you are definitely in menopause. And you know, people who are in menopause usually know they're in menopause. So I don't think the blood value tests are as helpful as just documenting the symptoms that you're going through and coming to the realization that there might be shifting going on, and that might be a trigger for the migraines.
Great, gotcha. I think documenting is always so important when it comes to migraine, so it's helpful to know that you do the same around hormones as well. Yeah. So I'm going to take us back to puberty. What is it about puberty that brings on migraine in women and men?
So again, we're looking at that shift in hormones. And what we actually see is that migraines become more common in girls who are turning into women, and less common in boys who are shifting into men. So this goes back to that idea of shifts in estrogen and also testosterone levels. As we get into our teenage years, women are starting to have an increased level of estrogen where their levels were much lower before. And that shift in estrogen level can sometimes serve as a trigger. And now you're going from stable level of hormone to having that cycle that's occurring that allows you to have that first period. So a lot of times we'll hear stories of patients who are telling us about when they started to have their first migraine or the first time they recall really ever getting headaches of any kind, and it's often linked to early years of having their periods. Whereas in boys who are shifting into men, they're having a shift in testosterone levels where their predominant hormone was estrogen, and they get into their teenage years and their testosterone levels start to rise. And as I mentioned earlier, we think that testosterone possibly has this anti-inflammatory, anti-pain effect. So if you start to increase this hormone that might naturally protect you from having symptoms of pain, that they might start to reduce having migraines. And a lot of times in our men patients, we'll hear they might have had a lot of migraines in their early years and then went through a large period of time where they basically were headache-free, and then they started to creep up more when they were under more stress or under more pressure at work, or there was major significant life changes, and now they're starting to have those symptoms returning.
What is the best way to treat migraine during puberty and then adolescence?
Yeah, so we take a look at treatment of migraine a little bit differently in children than we do in adults. We consider the diagnosis, and sometimes the migraine attacks can be much shorter. I think that a couple of things have been proven to be very beneficial in the pediatric age group. One of them has been that relationship with your provider. So having that really strong relationship with a clinician that is listening to your symptoms and talking through what you're feeling is that we think has actually had the most proven benefit. So that provider-patient relationship. The other thing is healthy lifestyle. I mean, I can't recall any teenager in the history of me meeting teenagers and then being a teenager where we have regular lifestyle function. You know, you're up late, eating a ton of junk food because you have this great metabolism. You think you can conquer the world, and you're not maybe doing the best things for your health. So an important factor is to recall that, you know, you need proper sleep. You need to have the same bedtime, the same wake time. You need to drink lots of water. You need to avoid a lot of that unhealthy food habits that can be a potential trigger for people with migraine. So that's usually where we start. And then to also recognize that you can't ignore the symptoms when you're having them. You need to treat them. You need to treat them early. For some patients, this just is lifestyle changes, and early treatment can be very effective. For others, they're going to need to start to investigate if they're having more frequent or more disabling attacks where they're missing quite a substantial amount of school. That do they need to start having a conversation about prevention?
When you talk about the lifestyle factors, it makes me want to have you come and talk to my teenage son, so we could arrange that. Well, in a study you published in 2015, you concluded triptans are the best therapy for menstrual migraine. Many people don't take them. Should they be?
I think that's a great question. We look at this gold standard in migraine treatment at this time of triptans. You know, triptans are an acute treatment option, something you take at the onset of a migraine. And it's supposed to basically resolve a lot of the migraine symptoms. But yet, when we take a look at the data, many patients aren't prescribed triptans. And even the ones that are prescribed triptans, many people don't actually go and refill the medication. And when I ask my patients, here, I've written you for this medication that you know is really effective because you've tried it, why aren't you always reaching for this medication when you're having migraine symptoms? And couple of things that we hear continuously is they're effective, but maybe not every single migraine attack. They're costly. So you get a certain number of pills a month. You want to save them for the worst of the worst. Or something else that we hear very frequently is, I take them, but I feel really tired and not so functional after, so I save it for when I know that I can take a quick nap or a quick rest. And if I'm in a situation where I'm really busy or I'm at work or have to drive my children, that I don't feel comfortable taking a triptan. So our article actually took a look at all of the data for menstrual migraines and how we treat them. And it found that there's one or two triptans that when taken as what we call a mini prevention, so they're used every day for a few days, to try to prevent the migraine coming on during menstrual time period, that there are one or two triptans that can be effective doing that. But there is a little bit of data suggesting things like naproxen, which is over-the-counter anti-inflammatory medication, taking for a long period of time around your menses can potentially prevent migraines without usually causing significant side effects. So for patients with menstrual migraine that are disabling, we will have strong conversations around prescription medications. You know, you're in bed because of this migraine, so if you need to take a little bit of a rest after taking treatment, that's still better than being in bed. You can still be functional for a part of your day, and so it's a good idea you get ahead of it, and how do we plan treatment around that? But for patients who feel like they can't take that medication right away, or they need to save that for later in the day, we come up with a plan of menstrual prevention where we're having them take something like an anti-inflammatory in the morning time to prevent the migraine onset, and maybe a triptan in the evening so they can rest and still prevent that morning migraine attack that might be coming around their period time. Other things patients can do when they're looking at how do I treat menstrual-related migraines is, well, if you don't have a period, you're probably not going to get that menstrual-related migraine. So looking at ways to reduce their frequency of menses. And so that's by thinking about continuous oral contraception, so ways where you're stopping that cyclic hormone change, or sometimes even considering things like an IUD with hormone. This isn't as well studied as taking continuous oral contraception, but sometimes it comes with less side effects in patients who don't tolerate oral contraception itself.
And you again have touched on this, and you just did, and you talked about lifestyle factors for teenagers, obviously, but what other strategies do you recommend for dealing with menstrual migraine beyond medication or birth control methods?
So we talk a lot to our patients about, if you know that you're going to get a menstrual migraine around your period, that to be prepared. So I think preparation is a big key. Sometimes we take for granted that we have medication and we're going to use it when we need it, but we don't carry it with us. So just being more aware of, if you're keeping that calendar and you're really aware your period's going to come and you know that your period's going to trigger a migraine, you should have your medication on you. And sometimes if they're really severe, I advise patients, hey, if you don't want to be on medication to try to treat this, then to consider that maybe you're not going to plan major events around your cycles so that you have the opportunity to take a break. You're not going to have a major meeting or a major dinner. Of course, this is near impossible to plan your life around your cycles, which is why we often end up having a plan for when you can't do that. Here's some options for medication to treat so that you can continue to be more functional.
So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit in a woman's life cycle and talk about how does pregnancy and breastfeeding affect migraine? Yeah.
So there's been some interesting research that's looked at how pregnancy and breastfeeding and the hormone cycling that occurs around that time can impact women. We used to think that every woman, when they get pregnant, they're not going to get migraines. It's just not something that happens. And more research has actually shown that while it's true, many women start to have improvement in migraines during pregnancy, and for some portion of those women continue to do well during breastfeeding, that there still is up to 30 to 40% of women who will have frequent migraines during pregnancy. And that can be really difficult because our treatment options start to be limited. So what we tell our patients is there's a chance that they're going to get better. There's a chance that they might remain better if they're breastfeeding. But if they don't, this is the plan that we're going to have in place to attempt to try to manage those migraines during pregnancy and breastfeeding. The other interesting thing is many women get better, but not until second trimester. And that's because first trimester can be so difficult for so many reasons. They often aren't telling people, they're still trying to work full time and really be that go-getter. And so they're not giving themselves a break. They're maybe not quite eating as they're supposed to be eating. They're not drinking enough fluid. They're thinking they can still do what they need to do, but they're exhausted and not allowing permission to themselves that, hey, I need to take a break because I'm growing another human being. You know, I need that rest, and it's important because I have a migraine brain. So it's not quite the same as someone who maybe doesn't have migraine. So when possible, we try to have these conversations before conception to tell them, you know, that first trimester might be difficult, even if you're going to do better later. So it's important you rest. It's important that you think about your exercise habits because exercise is really important. But maybe you're not going to be able to go for that run every day if you're exhausted, but a walk can be very helpful. Joining a yoga class and having a group of women who are also pregnant and at different stages not only is very supportive counseling-wise, but can be very healthy for you during that time period to learn different mechanisms to try to cope with symptoms of migraine itself. So having those conversations early can sometimes get somebody wrapped around that idea of, like, I have to change how I'm behaving once I get pregnant. And if I know that early, I'm going to be more aggressive about it than trying to catch up on that later.
And along those lines, what other treatments or therapies are safe to use when you're pregnant or breastfeeding?
Yeah, so something that I always like to have a conversation with my patients about early is, like, let me know when you're thinking about getting pregnant. We might proactively be asking our patients who are of childbearing years, you know, as a woman, are you on oral contraceptive or birth control? What is your birth control plan? Are you planning pregnancy and about when? Because we want to have a sense if they're on medications that might be considered dangerous when getting pregnant, that we're making sure they're aware of this in advance. And we have a conversation about, well, we need a certain amount of time to take you off that medication. This usually frightens people. If I'm on this plan that's working really well and you're going to take me off of this, so that leads to the natural conversation of what do you do when you're pregnant? So when we look at pregnancy, we look at migraine in general as two boxes of treatment, what you take when you have an attack and what you take to reduce the frequency. Many people don't need something to reduce the frequency of attacks, but everybody needs something to take when they're having an attack. So we talk through in pregnancy what are considered safer options compared to other things. So we might have a patient consider first lifestyle changes. Okay, you're getting a migraine. Make sure you lay down, you get some rest, drink plenty of fluid, be in a dark, quiet room, consider an ice pack, maybe even like some lavender, peppermint oil, or even like a cooling agent like camphor. So there's things like Vicks Vapor Rub or Tiger Balm that you can apply locally where you're having pain, and this can be very safe during pregnancy and you're not taking medication. If that step fails, then considering something like acetaminophen and metoclopramide. Metoclopramide is an anti-nausea medicine that's used frequently to treat migraine attacks that is actually considered relatively safe. And I say relatively because nothing is completely safe during pregnancy. So we might advise a combination like that. Sometimes our patients will have a neuromodulation device like the Cefely device, which we consider to be relatively safe in pregnancy. And so we'll have them use the acute device when they're having a migraine attack to treat the attack itself. So just some examples of things that we do. If the frequency starts to pick up and they need to consider prevention, we'll offer things like lidocaine-only nerve blocks to try to help reduce the frequency of cycles. We might consider certain preventive options as well, and that's a conversation we start to look at around second trimester when we think it's a little safer to add in a daily medication. And then that's very much based on the patient's comfort level and then also a conversation with their gynecologist to make sure everybody's on board and is okay with the same treatment. Another important thing is to realize that what you're on in pregnancy isn't quite the same thing that what's safe in breastfeeding. And that is actually a really hard concept for even me to think about because I'm like, well, if it's safe when you're making the baby, why can't we give it to the baby? But a lot of that has to do with when the baby's inside and the medication's getting filtered through the placenta. But the minute the baby's taking breast milk, it's all about how much that medication is binding to the milk and then crossing into the baby. So we actually might need to make some treatment changes when they're breastfeeding to treat because of safety in breastfeeding. So an example is that we might have a patient avoid non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medications in pregnancy, especially the first and third trimester, but that's actually one of the safest things to use when they're breastfeeding. So there's a change in how we might treat their migraines. Sometimes we'll have patients continue a triptan during pregnancy, but then they might have to change the type of triptan they're taking once they're breastfeeding, because we do have some evidence that elotriptan, for example, isn't bound as well in milk. So it's actually a safer option for patients to use to treat a migraine during breastfeeding, but not something we have any data about using during pregnancy. So there's a lot of moving parts and just educating the patients that they might have had a plan that worked in pregnancy, but you're going to check in within the first few weeks after you have the baby so we can discuss a complete changeover in your plan when you're breastfeeding if you're having migraines.
That's very good to know, and probably also brings comfort if you haven't had as much relief as you like during pregnancy,
right,
that you'll have some different options afterwards.
Right, right, that there's a change in plan.
Absolutely. Two of our viewers, Christine and Krista, would like to learn about the differences between menstrual migraine, perimenopausal, and menopausal migraine. Can you please speak to the similarities and differences?
Yeah, so the symptoms of migraine don't really change as you go through changes in your menstrual cycle, perimenopause, and menopause. But what happens is sometimes the frequency and the intensity can change. If you're having menstrual migraines during your reproductive years, they can be considered more severe for some patients and harder to treat, as I mentioned earlier. As you go into perimenopause, now you have some patients that were doing fine and didn't have menstrual-related migraines, all of a sudden having more frequent migraine attacks, not always related to menses, but because there's a lot of shifting in hormones, they can kind of occur at any time. Sometimes patients who go into menopause can have a drastic reduction in frequency of migraines. And this, again, the studies suggest, isn't as common as we used to think. Not every patient who hits menopause will have a resolution in migraines or an improvement, but about 60% of patients do see an improvement. I think that the one thing that we hear commonly as people go into menopause is they were so much more severe, they were so much more frequent. Now maybe I get one of those migraines every once in a while, but more often than not, I have milder types of headaches that I can take an over-the-counter medication and it's not so severe.
And for women that are entering perimenopause, how should their strategies change in treating their migraine? Or should they change?
Well, so if they're having a lot of irregularities in hormone cycling, sometimes we'll have them talk to the gynecologist about hormonal treatment. This can be a very dangerous thing for some women. If you've got a family history of breast cancer or high cardiovascular risk factors, hormone treatment can be difficult. Also, if you're perimenopausal but still having cycling, we might be considering like a continuous birth control factor, but that can actually also be risky after the age of 35. So a lot of it is thinking about low dose hormones, continuous to try to stabilize the hormonal fluctuations, but also safety factors. So just taking a look at the patient profile and seeing if this might be something that's safe to do. So we're not doing it for every patient, but a portion of patients we might consider. This is also a time that if someone wasn't on a preventive option before to reduce their frequency, we're now bringing up ideas about prevention. You might need to start a medication. We might need to be more aggressive with your plan so that we can reduce the frequency and kind of get you through that time period, which, as I said, can last up to 10 years for some patients.
Tanya said that her migraine attacks doubled during perimenopause. And is that common? And you've touched on this, but you know, why is that occurring?
Yeah. So I don't think it's necessarily common. We unfortunately don't have a lot of studies that take a look at how many women undergo that increase in migraines during perimenopausal period. But we do know that it's something to watch for. So if we have a patient that we've been seeing for a time period and they were pretty stable, or a new patient comes in and says, you know, I used to have an occasional migraine and I'm 43 and now all of a sudden I'm having frequent migraines, we'll start to wonder if it's related to perimenopausal symptoms. And then we start to ask them, have you noticed changes in your sleep cycle? Have you noticed changes in your moods? Have your periods been longer or shorter? Have you noticed longer or shorter intervals between them and they're not lasting as long, or they're heavier, or they're changing? And then we'll start to have that conversation about, well, it might be perimenopause and we think it's related to the very frequent cycling and changes in estrogen levels they're having during that time period. So these sudden shifts and drops can be triggers for starting a migraine cycle that then can be a little bit more difficult to treat.
You mentioned this, but my former neurologist did tell me that migraine attacks are likely to lessen after menopause, and I've held on to that hope. And do you see that in your practice? And how could I make sure that we are all in that camp, in that group?
How do you make sure you're that lucky?
Yes, exactly.
I wish I had an answer to that. If we could guarantee for patients that they're going to be the ones that are going to breeze into menopause and not have migraines, that would be fantastic. But at this time, we don't really have any data that suggests if you're on prevention before and have well-controlled migraines, that you're more likely to have reduced migraines after menopause. I do think it's more common than not that migraines reduce during menopause, but it's not a given. And I think that sometimes is really shocking for people who've been holding on to this, it's going to get better, it's going to get better, and then it doesn't. And they're like, well, I've been in menopause for years and I was guaranteed that it would go away and it hasn't. So I think just expecting that it might not change and not waiting to make a change about how you're treating them or how aggressive you're being about reducing the frequency if they're disabling. And I think that's important because sometimes people are very close to menopause and they're like, well, I'm just going to hang out like this because it's going to get better. And that doesn't necessarily happen. And then you've lost a couple years of your life. So it's really the piece of advice I have is don't assume, hope, but not to wait to treat, but to treat aggressively when you can.
Are women who have had total hysterectomies still susceptible to hormone-induced migraine attacks?
So I think this really depends on the age of the woman who has had a total hysterectomy. And by that, we're saying not only has their uterus been taken out, but their ovaries. So a lot of women will have a hysterectomy and then still have all those symptoms of their periods, and they're not clear what was done, right? They are like, I don't know, I had surgery and I'm not supposed to have periods, but they don't realize they still have ovaries, which of course then means they still have hormone fluctuations, which means they can still have migraines, but now they don't have bleeding, so they can't really relate it to when is it my period and I can be prepared and when is it not. We do see that some women who have to have a total hysterectomy before the time they were ready for menopause, so they weren't already naturally going into menopause, that sudden shift in hormone can be pretty drastic and send them into having more frequent migraines. And in those cases, you know, we do suggest hormone replacement therapy for a period of time, as long, again, as the safety factors are there, just to balance out that sudden drastic drop in estrogen, which it didn't happen naturally. It was a sudden drop, and that can be a big trigger for an increase in frequency and migraines.
You authored a paper on traditional and novel migraine therapy in the aging population. What should these viewers be thinking about?
So as we get older, our response to medications might remain the same, but the side effect profile might change. So our thought is as we get older that some of the medications that we might be taking might not necessarily be as safe. Example for this is a triptan. So we know that triptans are generally safe in healthy individuals who are younger, but as we get older and older, our risk factor for cardiovascular disease and our risk factor for things that might make a triptan not safe start to go up. So this one consideration we have to take into place. Another is medications that have what we call anticholinergic side effects. So tricyclic medications like amitriptyline, medications over the counter like Benadryl, which is diphenhydramine. Sometimes these medications can actually start to cause side effects when they weren't causing side effects before and potentially might lead to long-term outcomes as we get older. So it's a time to reconsider the treatments that you're on to make sure they're safe and that they're not interacting with maybe new medications medications that you've been put on for other health factors. So it's really important to have that reassessment as other medications are starting to come into play for other medical factors, and to not just assume that everything you've been taking most of your life to treat your migraines will continue to be safe as we get into kind of the better part of our life and the part where we're supposed to enjoy our life, but we're suffering with frequent migraines.
Sounds like it would be very individual, but what therapies would you recommend?
So a lot of times, depending on a patient's other health risk factors, we might be considering combinations of medications, like something over-the-counter combined with an antiemetic that might have some evidence for migraine. This is also a huge area of unmet need. So this is a place where we're really excited about some of the newer therapeutic options that we don't think have a lot of cardiovascular risk factors involved, that's what we might be bringing in. This is also a time that I really start to push for neuromodulation, though it's very expensive. So you might not have as much money on hand as you did before you were retired, but if you have a little bit of extra money, neuromodulation is generally considered safe as we get older and doesn't have any change in side effects. So we might be adding these things in to take acutely when a patient is having a migraine attack or not having as many side effects that we can be exposed to.
And for those who have been through breast cancer treatment, mm-hmm. What effects do estrogen blockers have on migraines?
Yeah, so I don't think that there's an overall one thing fits all. I think that many of my patients who've had breast cancer who are on treatments like tamoxifen get better. And it's always hard to say, is it because of the treatment or is it because of everything else they've been through and the shift in their hormone cycle? Sometimes people actually end up in earlier menopause and it happened over a period of a year, depending on the treatment. And because of that, their migraines are naturally starting to get better. I do have other patients, however, who don't tolerate these medications that well and actually have an increase in migraine frequency. So I don't find that my general sense is that they don't tend to trigger migraine, that some women get better, but there is a portion of women who, like any hormone or any medication, don't respond well and now start to have an increase in frequency. And it's a very difficult case because you're trying to manage two serious conditions which have completely different consequences, but trying to make the person make sure they have good quality of life.
Great, thank you. Is there anything else you would like for people living with migraine and headache to take away from this discussion?
I think that it's important to realize that when you have migraines, that you're kind of the captain of the ship here. So it's important to document, to keep track, to really have a good sense of what works for you and what doesn't. And if you feel that hormones are playing a role in your migraines, to track your cycles and other symptoms that you might have. So when you go in to see your provider and have a conversation about your migraines, you're coming in armed with all this information, and they sit down and they look it over with you so they can have a conversation about right treatment options for you.
Great. Are there any resources that you would like to recommend to our audience?
Sure. So there's a number of different websites that I will often refer my patients to just review general information, or also sometimes when they're going through a difficult time period, they feel like I'm alone and I really don't feel like anyone understands me. So I will often refer them to American Migraine Foundation, which is a huge resource of information for patient education material. And sometimes also I have preferred blogs that I think are really effective, and migraine.com I think is a really great one that has a huge source of information for patients. There's also CHAMP, which has their own website as a hub. It brings in a lot of different blogs and websites where patients can go to and kind of choose where they feel they can relate to and get information that I think is a little bit more valid than necessarily reading all of the stuff on the internet that can be overwhelming and not necessarily always accurate.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ilani. I know I personally have learned so much today, and we greatly appreciate your time. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me today.